Imagining Tomorrow with Emma Newman. Episode 5. Monitoring, Rescuing, Cleansing. Imagine a pleasant summer morning, a few years in the future, with the day stretching ahead of you. After a leisurely breakfast, you feel in need of company, so you pack your lunch, get your boots on, and walk down the towpath of the local canal that runs behind your housing estate. You meet up with three of your local waterways group, and over a cup of tea, you all look at the data gathered by the sensors dotted along the canal, reporting on the state of the water. Everything looks fine, apart from a spillage of some sort in one of the local rivers, and the sensors have already alerted that section's group so it can be resolved. You all decide to spend the morning tidying up some overhanging branches and clearing leaves out of sensor filters. By the time you're done, a message arrives on the group channel from a local farmer, letting everyone know that she traced the spillage to a problem with slurry storage, and it's being fixed with the help of the local waterways group. On the national channel, there are dozens of similar messages relating to the care of the thousands of miles of waterway threaded across the country. As you work, you chat with members of the local swimming group, who regularly enjoy that stretch of canal and often help with its maintenance. When you've finished the work, Brian, the one who always brings the tea in your group, pours everyone a cup and you all sit on the bank of the canal watching the dragonflies. He reminds everyone about the group's first day caring for that stretch of canal when you pulled 5 shopping trolleys out of the previously fetid water. "Hard to imagine that now," he says, as you watch the fish swimming in the beautiful clear water, the insects dancing above the surface, and the dragonflies glistening like jewels in the sunshine. That's just a snippet of a fictional future, inspired by the following conversations with people who are doing amazing things right now to combat or in some cases reverse environmental damage to create a better future for everyone. Join me as I explore their work and communities and imagine a tomorrow that is building hope in a changing climate instead of despair. These days, in the real world, the experience of living close to water can be a mixed blessing. I used to live in a small town in Somerset, and the walk to my son's primary school was along a river which was lovely, right up to the local sewage works, which used the waterway to discharge processed waste, creating some interesting foam. Recent news coverage of the state of Britain's waterways has elicited an outcry demonstrating how much we care about them. We are never very far from water in this country, and perhaps that's part of the problem. My father, Steve, lives in Salford Quays, a high-density housing and commercial development which includes over 20 acres of open water. He has wonderful views of the water from 2 small balconies, one of which has become a little bit famous over the past couple of years. It all started in the first lockdown, when we were coming to terms with COVID-19's sweep across the world. He noticed some of his plants had been disturbed, but he didn't know why. Then some friends in the same apartment block said they'd seen mallard ducks visiting the balconies.
One day I came onto the balcony, saw the mallard sat in one of my planters and was there for about an hour, and then she left. And when I went to look, there was an egg in the planter. That was the first time that year that we had one nest, and there was 7 eggs. And over a period of time, incubation, and then they hatched. And the interesting thing is that my balcony is 150 feet above the water. Although you can see all the water from my balcony, it's a long drop, and it's not onto grass, it's onto concrete and stone. So any babies jumping off, there was a high risk of mortality. So it was a case of we have to help. I couldn't just let them jump. And so I got a bucket and we started lowering down by buckets. That was the first year. It all went very smoothly.
Operation Mallard was born. Luckily, once hatched, ducklings never need to return to the original nest. Once they've made it to the water, the mother will make a new nest for them as close to the water as possible. If this sounds familiar, you might have seen it on the news or heard about it on the radio. The second year it happened, in 2021, I went onto the site previously known as Twitter and posted about how the local ducks seemed to have taken a shine to my father's balcony and him having to commando crawl across his living room so that he wouldn't disturb the latest nesting mallard. The thread went viral, and the story was featured on the BBC worldwide, on NPR, and multiple radio stations.
And then the next year, around about March time, we had another mallard visit, and I thought, okay. This time I reorganised the balcony for various reasons, and she decided to nest in a planter. And it's a larger planter, and that nest had 13 eggs in.
You have to understand just how smart these ducks were. They hadn't just picked a nice balcony with good views over the water and nice plants. They picked the one balcony in that whole building that was owned by a man who absolutely adores birds. He's been a keen ornithologist since the age of 11, when he could identify any bird of the British Isles by their bird song alone. He's been a member of the RSPB since the age of 14. This man couldn't have been more delighted to help get these ducklings down to the water safely. He thought that he was done for the year.
However, about a week and a half after the first Mrs. Mallard left, another mallard appeared. And this was quite a surprise. And she seemed to know what she was doing and everything else. And then we found out that the one that came in the March, the first one of that year, she was a different mallard, and we found out by checking the head markings, and they were slightly different. So we knew it was two different birds. So we had two nests that year, and then the following year we had another two nests, same birds. And all in all, I've had 50 ducklings hatch on my balcony and have been lowered down in a bucket down to the water's edge.
By the way, that bucket was named the Ducket by one of the thousands of people who followed Operation Mallard online. But why was this happening? Had the first one been a complete fluke, but then somehow news got round the local mallard community that there was a great place to nest? Bit high, but lovely chap will lower your kids down to the ground on hatching day. What was it about Steve's balcony in particular?
I don't think it's my balcony in particular as such. I mean, a lot of people don't have anything on their balcony other than just chairs. Some don't have any planters or anything like that. I think the major problem is that there is a lack of nesting sites for wildfowl on the Keys. You wouldn't think so. We've got over 20 acres of water here. But access to the water and, more importantly, egress from the water are very rare. There's only one or two places where ducklings can actually get out of the water once they've entered the water. It used to be a working port. There are steep sides, 2 metres high. There are steps going down, but they're still too high for a duckling to get out. So it's tough. We do have regular nests. There's usually about 6 or 7 different nests from different birds every year. But the mortality rate is very high, especially in the early nests. Because of other factors on the Keys, suitable nest sites, food, protection, weather conditions. There's a number of factors.
When I started to really understand this, it cast this initially joyful story in a different light. Even now, I'm worried that I'm in some way undermining the positive impact that this has had. But stay with me here. It's not the end of the story yet. I recently visited the Keys to get a deeper understanding of the relationship between the water, the wildlife, and the people. The area used to be a part of the former Manchester Docks, built in the 1890s, and is situated on the Manchester Ship Canal. There are large expanses of water, surrounded by quayside, where ships used to unload goods. But it fell into decline as a port in the 1970s, when global shipping moved to using containers, and the docks were too small to accept container ships. It became derelict by the 1980s, and its redevelopment was underway a decade later. The apartment block my father lives in was built in 2001, across the water from the Imperial War Museum and the Lowry Theatre. Salford Keys is a thriving location, home to the BBC and ITV. They make Coronation Street just a few minutes away. You can see the street set from the duck balcony. There's good connectivity to the centre of Manchester via tram, a theatre, shops, restaurants and bars. Literally thousands of people live and work here. And from the outside looking in, it looks like an exciting place to live. If you're a human, of course. When you look at the Keys from the perspective of wildlife, it's a different story. It's quite a hostile environment, in that most of it that isn't water is covered by stones and tarmac.
But it's like everywhere else. It could be improved. It's struggling. There's this fine balance between commercialism and bringing in wildlife and helping nature establish itself alongside the humans that are living here. And they struggle in certain areas. Water quality is improving, but it's the habitat for where wildfowl live and birds in general. We used to have kingfishers here. They've gone there because of the Metrolink extension down to Trafford Centre from Manchester City. The bank where the tram runs along, that's where they used to nest. That bank is no longer there, which is sad. General life for birds is pretty good. It's the waterfowl that struggle, ducks and geese in particular. And that's where it could be improved.
There are only a few metres of marginal plants, critical for duckling survival, out of hundreds of metres of quayside. I confess, when we spent all morning looking at the little pockets of nature desperately trying to survive, and knowing that the ducks had resorted to nesting 150 feet above the water, just to have somewhere relatively safe to incubate their clutch of eggs, I felt rather upset. But this is only a tiny sliver of the story of Salford Keys. It used to be a very different place.
I grew up around here. I know the area extremely well. And when I retired from the Navy, I went to Manchester University to do a business course. And then decided to settle here. I used to play here as a child, and there was nothing here. It was dangerous, just broken down warehouses, mainly concrete. There were no trees at all. And if you fell in the water, you didn't drown. You were instantly taken in the back of an ambulance to the nearest hospital and have your stomach pumped. The water, every bit of the water around here was dead. No life in it whatsoever.
This was the 1960s, when environmental regulation was not really at the top of many political agendas.
Yeah, it was interesting to come back and see what was happening here. In the time I'd been away in the Navy and coming back, and lots of recreation areas had been created, accommodation, houses, apartments, and they started sprouting up, but only half of it had been finished. So I've seen it develop over the time. Also what has developed is the ability of nature trying to blend in with the changes that have happened. And I have to accept that it was very dead on the Keys. There were ducks, there were geese, but they weren't doing much. There was no nesting sites from at all. In the early days, there were no fish because the water was dead. It was polluted. That was all cleaned up a couple of decades ago between Salford and Trafford councils. They did a reasonable job on that. Parts of the Keys were isolated from where the River Irwell comes into the Keys, and that became very clean water, lots of plant life in the water, which oxygenated the water as well as being aerated as well. And the fishing on the Keys is actually very, very good. And I've seen, even today walking around, I saw a carp about as long as my arm, probably about 30 pounds. That's just today. And I've seen pike as long as my leg on several occasions. So the wildlife's here.
Those sections of the Keys that are kept separate from the river are so clean that outdoor swimming competitions are held in them. We saw children jumping into that water with delight, their laughter echoing off the apartment buildings around them. You can see the plants in the water, it's so clean. When you look at the changes in my father's lifetime, it feels hopeful again, right? I mean, there are children playing in water that could have killed you, or at least made you very sick, when my father was their age. Fish are thriving in water that was once so polluted it threatened life. And there are trees where once there were none. It's not just the Keys. The River Irwell, which also feeds water into the Keys, is far healthier than it was just a few years ago, when it too was heavily polluted by the industries that initially brought prosperity to the region. But it's not that simple. A week before I interviewed Steve, an intense rainstorm after several weeks of drought showed how precarious life in the water at Salford Quays can be.
We lost thousands of fish because the oxygenation failed in the water and the balance of the oxygen the fish need to survive failed, and tens of thousands of fish died.
He was one of the first people to report the mass die-off as he discovered it on his early morning walk.
I took some videos and got in contact with the environmental agency, and it was on the news and everything else. It's just very sad. But other parts of the Keys, where there were plant life in the water, the fish didn't die. So there is room for improvement. The waters are monitored by both councils. We saw them doing it today. And I've talked to the people, they say, it's a fine balance. We still struggle sometimes, especially we've had long periods of drought, which we just had 4.5 weeks without rain, or it's incredibly wet, where the water level rises and it washes down rubbish from up in the Pennines. The River Irwell, which feeds the Keys, it's not filtered. It starts off in the hills about 45 miles away and meanders down through Bury, Ratcliffe, Rochdale, Prestwick, Manchester city centre and Salford city centre, and it all ends up in the Keys.
By the way, if you go to the show notes at www.foe.uk/imaginingtomorrow, you'll find links to the YouTube videos I made showing the ducklings being lowered to the ground in the ducket, along with other resources you might find useful if you're concerned about clean waterways. After visiting the Keys, I found myself wishing we could have something like the Starship Enterprise's sensor array, something that could give us instant, real-time information on water oxygen levels to help prevent this from happening again. Happily, I found a company that's inventing just that. The monitoring equipment, that is, not a starship.
We built a system for environmental monitoring. So it started out with water quality monitoring, looking at things like dissolved oxygen for fisheries. And then we very quickly realised there's a much larger use case, looking at additional uses for the technology, things like soil monitoring, weather monitoring, and along with water quality, because cross-referencing those data sets together makes it incredibly valuable.
This is Glyn, one of the co-founders of a company called Water, without the E, which makes a small multi-probe sensor system contained in a small box that sits in the water you want to monitor. It runs on solar power, monitoring water quality at different depths, including pH, oxygen reduction potential, dissolved oxygen, conductivity, water level and temperature. It sends you real-time data to your phone wirelessly, and it makes the Star Trek nerd part of my brain so very happy. But it doesn't stop there.
So we have our own batch of sensors, but we've now opened it up so that we can plug in other people's sensors. And this opens up a huge variety of different use cases and helps us with our company mission of improving water quality globally.
Funnily enough, it was Glyn's love of fishing that set him on the road to inventing this system.
I'm a very keen fisherman, and I was fishing at a local coarse lake. And the owner was telling me about a problem that he'd had in the previous year, where he had a large oxygen crash due to an algae bloom. He lost about £250,000 worth of stock. So it was a huge, huge problem for him commercially, but also, you know, horrendous for the environment and for the fish that lost their lives. So I asked him, you know, what he was doing about measuring that and why it happened and how he could prevent it. And he showed me this kind of handheld sensor that he had. So he'd wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning, walk around the lake, take a handheld reading, write it in a little notebook, and that would give him an idea of what the oxygen levels were in the lake that day. And at the time, I worked for a large technology firm, and we built IoT solutions for some of the world's biggest brands at that firm.
IoT stands for Internet of Things, which is a term used to describe all manner of devices, from fridges to smart light bulbs, to water monitoring systems having a connection to the internet, usually over Wi-Fi.
kind of looked at the situation, thought there's got to be a better way of doing this. And we built him a prototype, kind of like a proof of concept box with some real-time monitoring in it, which basically was to enable him not to have to get up at 3 a.m. and walk around the lake. And it would also give him an early warning if oxygen levels started to go down, then he could trigger things like aeration, movement in the water to try and kind of bring those levels back up again before they became a real problem. So that was how the idea started.
I told Glyn about what happened in Salford Keys and asked him if a monitoring system like his would have been able to prevent the mass die-off.
These kind of events are horrendous. You know, they're horrible to see. And sometimes they are unavoidable, but more often than not, they are avoidable. And they are either by just monitoring in real time or using AI for predictive and cross-referencing it with potential weather patterns. So we see it a lot with fisheries. So where we started our journey, the oxygen in fisheries is a very delicate balance. So, you know, measuring it is one thing, measuring the oxygen level, but, you know, it's effectively like a smoke detector if you're doing that. It's like, okay, there's a problem. There's nothing we can do about it, but there's a problem. What we're trying to bring in and what we're installing more and more of now is preventative measures. So for oxygen levels, it's quite easy. We can trigger, using our devices, we can trigger aeration and pumps and things like that. So actually what we can do is look at the levels, and as they start to drop, we can trigger the aeration to bring the level back up, rather than waiting until it's dropped to a critical level and then putting the aeration in, because, you know, more often than not, that's too late. So we're doing that with fisheries, triggering aeration. We also do that with some utilities companies, triggering things like pumps. So looking at the water quality in a reservoir or river, and then being able to trigger abstraction pumps based on the water quality. So looking at kind of, as well as measurement, but actually how we fix some of those problems. So I think with the Salford Keys, it was an extreme event. That amount of rainfall in that time was pretty extreme. However, that rainfall, to a certain extent, could have been predicted. And then certain measures could have been taken to ensure that it was less of a shock at once. Because the other thing that you get with large amounts of rainfall is you get huge amounts of runoff. And if there's been a prolonged dry period, no matter where it is, you know, pollution from cars, industrial, sits on the ground, sits on the fields. The longer it's dry for, the more builds up. And then when you have a huge amount of rain, all of that goes into the water at the same time. Whereas if it happens over a period of time, you know, the water course can handle it a bit better. It's a tricky one. I think there's definitely preventative measures that can be put in place, but also historical data. If we had data from, you know, events like that, what that can trigger is, you know, nature-based solutions. So you could look at it and go, okay, well, we've had this, you know, we have these extreme weather events. They are going to happen again in the future. We know we're seeing issues with water quality in these areas. So actually, let's have a tree planting program nearby, which will help kind of soak some of that up, or let's put some, you know, other nature-based solutions in place to kind of help when those extreme weather events do happen. Because if history is anything to go by, they're going to happen more and more moving forward.
Other nature-based solutions include ensuring there are plants in the water that can also help with increasing and maintaining oxygen levels, as Steve mentioned. Used in concert with real-time monitoring and measures taken to prevent pollution from coming down the River Irwell and from runoff, could make these events less damaging in the future. In fact, this real-time monitoring used in conjunction with AI is something that has already been used to great effect in the Smart Biosphere project.
So the Smart Biosphere project, they approached us a few years ago, and they had an idea for a brilliant project. The Devon catchment in Coombe Martin is a 6-kilometre piece of river with lots and lots of tributaries, and the terrain there is very, very steep. So what tends to happen is they tend to have, when there's large amounts of rainfall, everything just runs off, you know, fields, industrial, everything kind of runs into the sea. And it was at a point where they were about to lose their bathing water status. Their kind of mission was, let's look at a way that we can actually start to pinpoint where the issues are coming from. And then when we find where the issues are coming from, rather than, you know, hitting people with fines and things like that, let's try and educate and help and improve that bathing water as a community. And it was certainly the first project of that kind we had seen. where they really brought the community and the landowners and the farmers and everyone on board through communications. And it was, yeah, it was really nice going out on site and talking to these people, and they all had the same kind of mission to improve this local bathing water. In phase one, we installed around 50 sensors, and then the Smart Biosphere built an AI platform, so where all the data came into, and they could also look at trends, infer additional readings, you know, look at predictive water quality, and that was all built on the Siemens MindSphere platform. So they brought in a lot of partners into the project who, again, all had this kind of combined knowledge and the ability to deliver this project that was, you know, truly groundbreaking at the time.
And it was a success.
Yeah, so they've retained their bathing water status, and I think it's pinpointed a lot of issues that probably they didn't know were there. And also, you know, some of the things where we thought issues were going to come from, they weren't necessarily the culprit. And this happens on a lot of projects we work on. I think generally, you know, the finger gets pointed in a certain direction, but that's not always necessarily the case. And almost every project we work on, there's never one cause, it's multiple causes. You know, the education piece is far more important than just slapping fines. And what tends to happen with those fines is it's too late by that point. You know, when there's a big fish kill, or when there's, you know, a huge pollution event, you know, some of them have happened for a really long period of time. And actually, you know, the much better thing to do is to be able to have early warning systems to prevent those and fix them before they become disastrous, rather than wait until it happens and wait until, you know, thousands of fish have lost their lives, or, you know, people are getting ill from swimming in rivers or whatever it might be, and then finding the culprits.
And that's what's at stake here. This is about our responsibility to the waterways and the right to access clean water for all living things, whether that's for bathing, for drinking, for rearing young. By the way, if you've been enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe. Can you imagine a world where everyone had access to clean water? It feels impossible, but accessing water that is safe to swim in has been achieved in a small pocket of Devon, thanks to the use of cutting-edge technology being used in concert with strong community efforts and education. I asked fellow science fiction writer Rochelle Atala to help me imagine a world where we did have that, everywhere. What would it feel like to live in a world where we all had access to clean water?
I think I would like to feel like I was less anxious. I think, I know that sounds really basic, but I actually think we're probably all suffering from quite a lot of anxiety because of the way we all live, particularly right now. And I think if we had access to water spaces, guaranteed clean water, you know, that wasn't something that we were worrying about, I just think I would walk around feeling less anxious and feeling safer. I think everybody wants to feel safe in the world. And I don't think that's much to ask for, but actually I think genuinely very few people do feel safe, or they worry about the safety of the generations coming behind them.
That anxiety caused by losing access to clean water is something she explores in her book, Thirsty Animals.
And I found that quite interesting that with my novel, Thirsty Animals, just people that knew me read it, and then they kind of wanted me to almost be like the water police. Like, they wanted me to hear their like water confessions, you know, of like, oh, this had a leak and I didn't sort it. And I'm like, you know, the fact that we're even just having this conversation and that you are conscious is a really beautiful thing. You know, you're engaged. I guess that's the power of stories. You know, it's much easier to kind of engage and find empathy in a narrative than it is to read an article sometimes.
We both write dark visions of the future, but what I want to do now is think about how it could be better. In turning away from writing dystopian fiction, I'm now seeking a more utopian approach to imagining our future. So I asked Rochelle what the future she'd like to live in looks like.
I mean, in my utopia, I suppose, I imagine particularly in an urban environment, I want to see the canals come alive again. I want to see what happens when we have these spaces that we don't even really access anymore, there's a canal quite near where I live in Glasgow, and there's lovely walks there, and you are starting to see life come back to it because the city are starting to appreciate that we need blue space, blue bodies of water in cities, and how important, not just for kind of for visual and for our own mental health, although that really does help. In the face of the climate emergency and the fact that we more and more people are living in urban spaces, you know, I think we have to find a way to bring biodiversity and nature and be able to live alongside it.
The regeneration of canals and the regeneration of places like the old Manchester docks into Salford Quays means a reimagining of the space and reprioritisation of nature that is pretty much the opposite of how these waterways came about. As Rochelle said,
I think it's obviously something that we can't really shy away from, the fact that we live in a capitalist society, and that seems to be the form that takes hold of everything. And I think when everything is kind of modelled on results of capitalism and profit, then you very quickly forget the other things that actually make people happy, as well as just kind of like worrying about nature and animals and landscapes. I assume when cities, when industrialization came along, that was not a priority. The priority was, how can we make money as quickly as possible? How can we get as many people into one space to make money? And I think it's now, as we're seeing the effects really of industrialization and kind of the drive, when we're seeing these effects of climate change, it's now we're like, okay, actually we need to roll back. We need to kind of come back to a place, what creates a harmony for all of us, you know, and the planet. And we, again, it's that thing, it seems so simple to say, but we are all so connected.
Bringing about the necessary reprioritisation to make room for nature while still living in the societal structures she describes is so hard. There are literally thousands of people in the UK already volunteering their time and effort into cleaning up waterways. And community action is the only way, I feel, that we will ever get a future that contains clean canals and rivers and beaches for everyone. Because it's not just dredging litter out of city canals or reclaiming overgrown towpaths. It's the kind of consistent community engagement that we saw in the Devon Biosphere project that's required. And that takes time and energy. In our conversation, we decided that seeing as we were imagining utopia, we could play with the idea of having universal basic income. This is not a new idea by any stretch. In fact, it almost became a reality in America in the 1960s. The policy of defeating poverty by awarding every person a minimum income, no strings attached, being supported by both Republicans and Democrats, before being defeated in the Senate by the Democrats because they felt the amount being proposed wasn't high enough. I heartily recommend the book Utopia for Realists by Rutger Bregman, in which he explores the history of the idea, how the economics would work, and the impressive amount of evidence from real-world trials that it would be a really good thing for our society. Back to our imagined utopia, implementing universal basic income would free people up from the grind of survival so they have the time and the financial safety net to be able to put more time and energy into community projects that could give all of us access to clean waterways.
I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, even to have the opportunity, or for someone to feel like they had the freedom and time and space to be able to explore something like that and actually reconnect. I think that, again, is one of the symptoms of capitalism. We're quite disconnected from actually what makes us better as people. We're very much kind of individualistically stuck in the grind, so to speak. And I think we're probably at a place now where although we are still at the mercy of capitalism, on an individual level, a lot of people are going, actually, this doesn't work for me now. You know, I'm working 50 hours a week. I'm not making enough money to pay my bills, feed my family. What is the point? If this system doesn't work for the majority of people, then kind of what is the point? And so I think a revolution of sorts would be quite nice. But I do think more and more people are asking that question. And when they're asking that question, they are starting to think, well, actually, what would as a society make us happy? How do we reconnect? What invigorates us when we get up in the morning. And actually so much of that is to do with being connected to the wider world, to each other and to nature. So yes, I'm like, you know, let's go for it.
So let's have a look at how feasible this vision of the future could be. We already have the water monitoring technology that I talked to Glyn about. We have people who have the time and freedom to really start to re-engage with the environment. Remember the description at the start of this episode? That's what it could look like. But Em, I hear you say, we might have that technology, but we don't have universal basic income. People don't have that time and freedom now, and certainly not the money to make this happen where they live. So how do we actually get there from where we are now? If we're making a roadmap to get to this sliver of utopia, what's the next step we can take on that journey? Universal basic income seems a very long way off, but some people are already benefiting from the implementation of the four-day week without a drop in pay. And that societal shift does seem to have real momentum at the moment. So let's hope that becomes standard and frees up just a little bit of time and energy for community projects. In this cost of living crisis we're all suffering from, it feels like lack of money is the big hurdle to overcome. I asked Glyn about whether there was any funding available for community groups who would be interested in using the water monitors along stretches of water they care for.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of kind of local funds available to landowners and groups of people. And then there's also, you know, funds via DEFRA, who, you know, farmers, etc., can go out and apply for, where they'll, you know, fund a large chunk of these kind of programs of work. And then another thing that we see that's really successful is for local groups where they have a particular interest in a local piece of water, whether it's a chalk stream or a bathing water, things like that, is doing like local crowdfunds, using crowdfunding pages to basically say, okay, we need to raise X amount of money to be able to do this. We need to monitor the water, and then we want to be able to see the data on our website, etc. And they'll do like a local crowdfund. And actually what we find is the local communities, you know, are all very happy to put in a small amount of money to protect the areas that they live and the pieces of water that they love for whatever reason, whether it's walking beside it, swimming in it, paddleboarding, whatever it might be. The local community seem to buy into it a lot.
I asked him if the first step would be to get in touch with Water, the company he co-founded.
Yeah, so we go out and speak to local groups, and we'll go and, you know, we'll look at the river, we'll find out what it is they want to achieve, and then we'll kind of put something forward to them, say, okay, if that's what you want to achieve, you want to be measuring this, you want the data every hour, and then this is how much it's going to cost. And then we have as well, you know, advised them on best ways to fund it. So a few of them, we can actually put them in contact with their local catchment team at the water companies. Quite often, the water companies will fund monitoring and actually work with these local groups. So that's happened quite a few times for us. And we've even helped people set up crowdfunding campaigns to fund them. So for us, it's you know, it's about getting more data and helping more of those waterways.
Crowdfunding campaigns take work and dedication, but they have been successful for many community groups. And with someone like Glyn to give expert advice, it will be even more likely to be successful. Whether the funding is raised by the community or provided through grants available from DEFRA or your local water authority, being able to actively monitor water in your local environment this way won't just give you information on its quality. It will bring the community together and empower everyone who takes an interest in ensuring that access to clean water.
And one of the things we do and we tend to give people to use is we have a citizen science app. So if people see issues with water quality, or if they see an issue that, you know, clearly visible, there's a pollution event or there's fish, like in the Salford Keys, they can report it through the app. We also then have test kits that they can use to test the water and submit that through the app. So they can submit the result through the app. And that really starts to build a big picture. And it's that empowerment piece that you just said. It's kind of local communities taking an interest in the quality of the water, And then, you know, it just helps so much with that education piece and bringing further engagement when you're actually bringing people on board and saying, you can be part of this. You can be part of the measurements of this water quality.
Going back to Salford Quays, just the addition of floating beds at the edges of the water that provide marginal plants will help ducklings to survive. Expanding stretches of sloped access to the water will give waterfowl better nesting sites, so my father doesn't need to keep lowering ducklings down to the ground in a bucket. Floating reed beds and more aquatic plants will help with natural oxygenation too. It's so much better there than it used to be. And as I said, the story of Salford Quays isn't over yet. I'd like to think its next chapter will see even more improvements made to benefit nature, as more people become aware of the importance of increasing biodiversity. If you live there, or somewhere similar, there may well be a local residents group where you might be able to find people who'd be interested in helping to raise funds to do this, or put pressure on the site management companies to do this as part of their obligations as landowners. Of course, all the community will in the world can't clean up pollution permitted by loopholes and poor regulation. Consistent pressure on government to hold people accountable for the management of sewerage and other potential pollutants is required, especially as so many environmental protections enshrined in European law are now under threat because of Brexit. Your local Friends of the Earth group will be able to help you to campaign for this, so you could get in touch with them. If you are already in a community group that's looking after a stretch of water, or you are aware of some exciting new developments in this area, let me know. Email me at podcast@enewman.co.uk and who knows, you may be featured on a future episode. I'm going to leave you with something from the interview with Rochelle and wish you strength and hope as we travel together towards a better future.
I think it's only through kind of community can you really have active and progressive change. But you see it, you know. I think even just from some of those examples we were talking about earlier, people are coming together and are doing amazing things, you know, whether that is looking after the water quality or at least worrying about the water quality in local walks, like near where I live, so that they continue to swim in it and see the animals and the fish and, you know, all sorts of insects that are coming there that never used to. We are seeing good. We are seeing goodness, and I think that certainly offers me hope as someone that can write quite dark fiction.
Please do subscribe if you've enjoyed this episode, and if you have a moment to leave a review, to tell a friend about it, or mention it on social media, that would be wonderful. You've just listened to an episode of Imagining Tomorrow, brought to you in partnership with Friends of the Earth. It was researched, written, and produced by Emma Newman. To find out more about Emma's work, go to www.enewman.co.uk. If you'd like to find out more about how Friends of the Earth can help you and your local community to take action on a wide variety of issues, and maybe make some friends in the process, then go to foe.uk/community-group. Details about the people featured in this episode can be found in the show notes at foe.uk/imagining-tomorrow, along with some resources you might find helpful. Have you got a similar story of hope and innovation to share? Have you been inspired by this episode? Tell me about it. You can email me at podcast@enewman.co.uk. I hope that you're inspired to imagine a better tomorrow.